Gregor, host of Lost in Your Mind, where we explore life through Alan Watts talks. Alan Watts was an amazing philosopher loved by millions who brought to the U.S. the wisdom of Zen Buddhism, Hinduism, yoga, consciousness, meditation, and the true self. So join us Wednesday nights at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time as we explore life through Alan Watts talks on Lost in Your Mind.
Stay tuned for more live programming on Progressive Radio Network.
Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin, Senior Vice President of Global Strategic Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are entirely unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Good morning, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Richard Martin here with Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. I think we're going to start with some very shocking news from Australia overnight. The National Australia Bank has decided to write off 90% of its U.S. conduit loans. Now, the conduit loans are another way of expressing the level three debts that I have discussed with you many times, level three debts having no market and are therefore unpriceable, the bottom range of the mortgage debt. And as if that wasn't enough, Americans are facing unprecedented demographic and pension medical care cost expansion. It simply isn't possible to tax three workers enough to pay for one retiree. You know, as the empire of debt collapses, so too will employment based on ever more debt and borrowing, and it's easy to see the worker-retiree ratio dropping to 2-to-1 or even lower. It's simply unsustainable. And even as healthcare costs skyrocket, the nation seems to be acquiring ever more chronic health problems, many related to poor diet and lifestyle choices. Well, as the dollar has collapsed, owners of U.S. debt have suffered stupendous losses, yet they've kept on buying for fear that if they stop funding the empire of debt, their own sales to the U.S. will decline. Yet when does this propping up of the empire become good money tossed in after bad? When does the U.S. contraction of consumer spending start removing some of those surplus dollars from their hands? When does domestic political pressure build to invest some of those trillions in their own nations rather than toss them in the garbage heap of U.S. debt? You know, with healthcare costs continuing to skyrocket as chronic health issues rise and the cost and range of these available treatments expands, pension and entitlement programs designed for 10 workers for every retiree now facing 3-to-1 or even lower worker-retiree ratios. The U.S. current account deficit is unsustainable, as is its debt-swollen domestic consumer spending. Stagnant and declining wages and rising unemployment are the inevitable result of reduced borrowing and spending by consumers and government alike. All right, ladies and gentlemen, this is Richard Martin, Richard Martin's Wake Up Call, coming to you from my office here at Global Strategic Investments in Miami, Florida, via the good offices of the Progressive Radio Network in New York City. My phone number, my call-in line, which I encourage all of you to use with questions and comments, toll-free is 888-873-4643. Repeat that. 888-873-4643. Please feel free also to write me an email with your questions, comments, and observations to the following address, rmartin@gscorporation.com. I will repeat that. Please remember that the GS stands for Global Strategic, for obvious reasons, and the word corporation needs to be written out in full, corporation. Okay, once more, my email address, rmartin@gscorporation.com. Right? And finally, if you would like to call me privately with questions and concerns, you may do so by calling my direct line at any time, preferably not at 3 o'clock in the morning, at other times gratefully received. Your number is 305-357-5575. Repeat that. My direct line for your private calls would be 305-357-5575. Okay? Right. Well, under the circumstances, and because of what's going on and the seriousness of the situation, which has really now changed its focus from the housing market to the banking sector, you know, we just had two more banks which closed their doors towards the end of last week. I think I need to talk a little bit about banks and banking and the implications of the problem as seen from the banking perspective. First of all, just remember that the bailout of IndyMac depositors will deplete about 13% of the FDIC's available reserves, which is, of course, considerable, and means that another 7 or 8 banks of the proportions of IndyMac only have to go out of business to clean out the complete reserves of the FDIC, which, of course, brings in more problems. It's clear, obviously, that the Congress will back up the FDIC if the FDIC either runs out of Treasury bills to sell has any other need to raise money or to pay off depositors of insolvent banks. Obviously, the question is where Congress will get this money. And the answer, of course, is from the Federal Reserve System if the lenders won't fork over the money themselves. The Federal Reserve System backs up Congress, which is, of course, the heart of the threat to the solvency of the dollar itself. So anyway, $4 billion is what the FDIC will pay to the depositors of IndyMac not covered by the $100,000 maximum payment from the FDIC itself. Remember, they are all borrowed short and lent long. The failure of IndyMac was, in fact, unique. We've not seen a bank failure this large since 1984. And this, of course, comes as a rude shock and a reminder to the general public that individual banks can, in fact, go bankrupt. Now, remember that the most common reason for bankruptcy is that the bank has lent money to purchasers of real estate, which is long-term debt, yet depositors have the right to withdraw the money at any time. The bank, therefore, is lent long and borrowed short. And this, of course, is true of every bank. The ones that get caught, which is a rare event, have merely indulged in long-term lending more than the average bank. That's the basis of the problem. The failure of any individual bank doesn't produce mass panic anymore. It has been so long since Americans have seen a bank run, they pay no attention to a rare bank failure. Because the FDIC at this time does have sufficient reserves in Treasury debt to sell and compensate depositors, depositors around the country are not tempted to go to their bank and demand currency. The fact that the FDIC could cover the deposits of no more than a dozen banks, the size of IndyMac, doesn't seem to disturb them. They actually know nothing about the FDIC other than the crucial fact the United States government stands behind it. The government will recapitalize the FDIC. The experts who really do understand the nature of the bank deposit insurance program as incarnated by the FDIC know that the Federal Reserve System in turn stands behind the federal government. So there's no question that individual depositors in individual banks will be bailed out by the FDIC directly or by the United States government through the FDIC if the FDIC runs out of T-bills to sell. What will happen when the Federal Reserve System runs out of Treasury debt to sell or swap? It has unloaded almost 40% of its holdings since last December. Americans have seen very few bank failures ever since the establishment of the FDIC in 1934. Depositors trust the FDIC to intervene and protect the money in their bank accounts. They do not withdraw currency from their accounts in a banking crisis because they believe that the FDIC will intervene to protect them. This is the confidence which has kept almost all American banks from experiencing bank runs since 1934. This is the most important of all moral hazards. A moral hazard is the expected subsidy from the government to protect investors from a major collapse that their own stupidity and greed has caused. All the talk by Ben Bernanke or anyone else about trying to avoid moral hazard is propaganda. Moral hazard is behind the banking system, beginning with the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. The entire banking system rests on this premise. The banking system must be saved from bad investment decisions of reckless bankers whose banks go bankrupt, thereby causing doubts about the solvency of an entire system that is borrowed short and lent wrong, a system built on a lie, namely, we will pay you interest by lending out your deposit, but everyone can get his money back at any time. The FDIC was set up to use government money if required to protect bankers against two groups, depositors and foolhardy rival bankers who go bust. Bankers fear depositors' decisions to withdraw currency, thereby imploding the fractionally reserved banking system. They fear busted banks because of the potential domino effect. When an individual withdraws currency from his bank account, he reverses the expansion process of fractional reserve banking, which I have talked about and which actually was the subject of my very first broadcast on Progressive Radio Network. Remember, for every paper dollar that an individual deposits, the banking system as a whole multiplies the quantity of money by 9 to 1. It may actually multiply it even more if this deposit is not in an urban bank. Similarly, when a person withdraws currency from his bank and doesn't redeposit it, the banking system contracts the deposits by 9 to 1. So who withdraws currency from a bank? Well, you and I withdraw currency from the ATMs, but we intend to spend this currency. Whenever we spend it, it winds up in the cash drawer of a retail company. The company at the end of the day deposits this currency into its bank, so the banking system as a whole does not experience contraction. The money supply, therefore, does not contract. The only contraction that is permanent is the contraction of currency withdrawn from a local bank and then sent to dependents outside the United States. When this is done, there is a permanent contraction of digital money in the banking system. But this rate of withdrawal is fairly constant, and so the banking system does not contract unexpectedly. This process actually reduces the rate of monetary inflation and the rate of price inflation in the United States. Immigrants send money to their relatives, and American consumers find that imported goods are paid for, in effect, by pieces of paper with presidents' pictures on them. Foreigners do not use the money to buy American goods, leaving prices lower in the United States than they otherwise would have been. The banking system as a whole is not threatened by individual bank failures. The money that a failed bank has lent out does not disappear when the lending bank fails. It remains in circulation. The money that depositors might otherwise have lost is returned to them by the FDIC. So individual bank failures do not alter the total money supply. Those few individuals who deposited more than $100,000 in accounts at a local bank that failed will lose most of their money above $100,000. They have learned their lesson through IndyMac. it is likely that wealthy depositors have already taken steps by now to defend themselves against further bank failures. They have spread the money around. If not, they are slow learners. The problem with individual bank failures is not the threat of a collapsing banking system. The problem is that bank failures send messages to depositors. The economy is being managed by people who do not have good economic judgment. Depositors begin to distrust the economy as a whole. It isn't that they distrust the banking system as a whole. There is nothing they can do individually to pull the plug on the banking system as a whole other than withdrawing all of their money from the bank and sending it abroad to people they barely know. This, of course, is not going to happen. The threat to the banking system is that failed banks are a yellow flag to consumers. It warns them that the economy as a whole is at risk. Bank failures testify to the incompetence of supposed experts who manage the public's money. When the average investor begins to lose confidence in the money managers, they may decide that discretion is the better part of valor. At some point, he will call his pension fund or stock mutual fund and tell the person at the other end of the line to sell the stocks. He will have to buy something, and what he will buy will be short-term money market instruments. He may also buy U.S. Treasury bonds. The problem with this is that long-term money, meaning long-term capital to be used in long-term projects, will become less available. The government will spend any money that the public invests in Treasury debt. Businesses will find that it is more difficult to gain access to long-term capital. This will slow the rate of economic growth in the United States. This will remove the engine of economic growth. By moving their money out of the private sector, and especially out of equities, investors will contract the overall economy. It is not that individual bank failures threaten the banking system as a whole. The banking system as a whole is a gigantic cartel. And this cartel has as its protector the Federal Reserve System. The Federal Reserve System is legally allowed to monetize anything it wants to monetize. It can buy any asset, and it can create the money to buy that asset. The Federal Reserve can intervene to save individual banks or large financial institutions. Not only can it do this, it is doing this on a constant basis. Beginning in December 2007, the Federal Reserve has sold Treasury debt whenever it has increased its purchase of questionable assets that it has bought from banks and large financial institutions. It has unloaded about 40% of its holdings of liquid Treasury debt. This has kept it from inflating the money supply at a dramatic rate. At some point, it will run out of Treasury debt to sell to the general public in order to offset the increase of its purchase of questionable assets held by the financial system. And that, of course, is the point where we need to decide whether hyperinflation will follow as a result of the Federal Reserve printing money, or whether the system will simply be allowed to go into default. And that is the bone of contention that I share with people who believe that the Fed will throw all caution to the winds and simply create money by printing it 24 hours a day. My contention is that it will not do this. Zimbabwe is a case in point. As soon as you start printing money willy-nilly in order to create a stopgap for debt in general, you create hyperinflation, and immediately the Federal Reserve will lose its credibility and probably be voted out of business. Therefore, I believe it will not do that. And that is why, ladies and gentlemen, we will see the ultimate meltdown of the system, because money will simply not be made available to stopgap the problem, and therefore there will be mass bankruptcies, and they will happen very quickly and in short order. See, the major threat to the banking system is from outside the banking system. The major threat is the insolvency of a major company that has guaranteed the bonds of private corporation and agency bonds of the United States government, such as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. These supposed guarantees have made possible the system of bond portfolios that can be broken up into 125 levels of risk with appropriate rates of return on each of the slices. The system, in fact, is so complex that no one understands it. Hedge funds that we were talking about on Gary's show last week have invested in these assets called collateralized mortgage obligations. It is, in fact, the hedge funds that have borrowed from the banks to buy them. The leverage of the hedge fund system is enormous. It is probably 100 to 1. The guarantees against loss that undergird the financial system are guarantees made by organizations that cannot possibly fulfill their contracts during an anomalous event such as an attack on Iran or by the Israeli Air Force. When the promises cannot be fulfilled, ladies and gentlemen, interest rates will rise for all American bonds except those of the United States Treasury, which will trigger additional demands placed on the guarantors of these contracts, which will threaten the solvency of the bond system as a whole. At that point, bank capital will collapse as a result of the losses that the banks have sustained because they lent hedge funds money to invest in the bonds. The collapse of the Carlyle Capital Corp earlier this year took less than 1 week. It was borrowed at least 32 to 1 by 10 major banks of the United States. Those banks lost 100% of these investments in 1 week. When banks lose capital, they must either find new investors or else they must reduce their loans. When they reduce their loans, they refuse to roll over existing lines of credit to American corporations. This is the major threat to the system. It is not a threat of the bankruptcy of the banks. It is the threat of the reduction of lines to credit to American corporations, corporations that are dependent on these lines of credit. In a financial panic, American investors will move from corporate bonds and stocks and put their money in treasury debt. This threatens the solvency, not simply of individual banks, but of individual corporations that are dependent upon lines of credit issued by specific banks. American corporations are not dependent on the banking system as a whole. They are dependent on continuing lines of credit from specific banks. They do not have time to renegotiate loans with other banks. They have to meet their payrolls. This will become increasingly difficult to do in the environment created by constant reports of individual failures of specific banks. This is the famous and widely denied crowding out effect. The federal government's debt certificates are trusted. The private capital markets are less trusted. In order for the private capital markets to continue to operate in such a hostile environment, they will have to offer greater economic returns than treasury debt. It will become more expensive for private companies to attract long-term investment precisely because individual banks are failing. Obviously, the companies would all fail if the banking system as a whole collapsed. The entire society's existence would be at risk if the entire banking system collapsed. There is no safeguard against such a scenario. The division of labor would collapse. Cities would not be resupplied with goods. It would be like all disaster movies combined. It would take only a matter of weeks for the death rate to jump. The problem is the crowding out by government, especially the federal government, of capital that otherwise has gone into the private sector. The threat is the long-term erosion of confidence in the private capital markets. This is not a minor threat. This is a major threat. It threatens the long-term growth of the American economy. It threatens the long-term growth of an economy which is heavily indebted to foreign investors. When foreign investors perceive that growth has stopped, they are going to cease lending money to Americans to sustain their present patterns of consumption. The price of imported goods will increase. The public will have to readjust its household budgets. When the public must readjust spending patterns, the result is recession. In a major readjustment of their budgets, the result is a deep depression. We have not seen this since the 1930s. When we read of more bank failures, we will grow more nervous. It is not that tens of millions of depositors will go down to their banks and take out currency. A few million people may do this to a limited extent, but most people will not. This is because they do not have sufficient reserves in their bank accounts to enable them to take out $1,000 in currency and not use that money to spend on household bills. So they won't do this, although you probably should. The long-run effectiveness of withdrawing currency to protect yourself from a complete collapse is essentially useless. You cannot buy much in a complete collapse. Most things are produced and delivered based on bank credit. We are hooked. What is likely in a scenario of failing banks is the increasing loss of public confidence in the private capital markets. When that happens, the rush to buy treasury debt, which means the rush to hand over economic future to the United States Congress, will lead to the decapitalization of the private companies that increase American standard of living. The public has encouraged the United States government to protect voters from unexpected bank failures, and Congress has complied. The banking cartel has welcomed this cooperation. The Federal Reserve System has inflated. The dollar has depreciated by 95% since 1914. This is a result of the creation of the Federal Reserve System, which was created in the name of stable money. In other words, it is one more example of Ludwig von Mises' rule. Whenever the government interferes with the market, the result will be the opposite of what the legislators said they intended to achieve. So, we face a depression. We face bankruptcies of over-leveraged small banks like IndyMax. But the large banks are far more leveraged than the public understands. They have lent huge chunks of their capital to hedge funds that are leveraged 100 to 1. A 1% move opposite to what a hedge fund has expected can wipe out 100% of a 100 to 1 fund's equity. It can be insolvent faster than you can say Carlyle Capital Corporation. Warren Buffett says that the stages of the investment cycle is managed by three successive groups. First, the innovators. Second, the imitators. Third, the idiots. We are well into stage three. Well, in 1998, a weekend intervention by the president of the New York Federal Reserve Bank got a dozen banks to pony up $3.6 billion of new loans to keep the insolvent long-term capital management hedge fund. The fund was leveraged 30 to 1 and would have to sell off $125 billion in assets at a loss. Since much of the portfolio was in assets that had fallen to zero, defaulted Russian bonds, this would have been painful. Sales of the liquid assets would have collapsed the international bond market. The bailout gave the banks time to sell the still marketable assets over the next 2 years. Well, now, ladies and gentlemen, the hedge funds are international. The obligations are in the trillions. Who can bail out a large busted fund now? The banks are in hock to all of them, and any one of them can bring down the system. All right, there we go. Simon from New York, welcome to the show. Hi, how are you?
Fine. Richard, when I listen to you, I get very nervous. Should I short the market? What should I do? I don't know what to do. It's very nerve-wracking.
Well, I would certainly short the market, sure, by the inverse leveraged funds, the 200% inverse leveraged exchange-traded funds, or short the market. Yeah, you might have to see a little bit of upward motion in the market before the market really collapses, but sure, the market will collapse, and at that point, you know, I will give the word to my investors. But yes, you could short the market, absolutely, and continue to worry and continue to be nervous. That's when you make your best decision, through nerves. So I'm very pleased to hear this. Sorry.
Can you tell me which funds to do?
No, I can't go into details. I'm actually not allowed to by the rules of the SEC and FINRA. I'm not allowed to give, you know, blanket recommendations over the phone. But if you want to call me, I'd be glad to discuss it with you.
Okay. But I should do it now? I should do the short now?
Now, it could be now. I mean, it depends, you know, if you are prepared to see a little bit of a move against you. I don't know that the market will go down today, tomorrow, next week. I think it will go down before the end of the summer. It may go down today, it may not. But I would, in general, consider selling short or buying the inverse-related ETFs.
And you don't like gold?
I am not a fan of gold. I think that gold is simply an asset that will lose price but gain value. And I've discussed this before, Simon, so I don't really want to go into it again. But I think the value of gold can rise as the price falls. That's how I see the future of gold in the general monetary system.
Okay, so just hold cash and short the market.
Oh, cash, treasury bills, and short the market, yeah.
Thank you very much.
Okay? Not at all. Pleasure. Nice to talk to you, Simon.
Thank you.
Very quickly, ladies and gentlemen, I am glad to bring you Alan Greenspan's book in a way which means that Alan Greenspan himself will not profit from it. This gives me great pleasure and warms the cockles of my heart. If you would please grab a pencil and take down this website. It is very, very simple. S-C-R-I-B-D. Six letters. That's all you have to write. S for sugar. C for Charlie. R for Richard. I for Ireland. B for Barry. And D for David. .com. S-C-R-I-B-D.com. Once more. Sugar, Christopher, Raymond, India, Barry, David. S-C-R-I-B-D.com. When the page comes up, put the name Greenspan in the search box and then click on The Age of Turbulence, which is his new book. And you will get a complete book to download or to read completely free of charge. Excellent work. The Age of Turbulence, an e-book. Underneath that, underneath the heading The Age of Turbulence, you will actually also find an article written by the loathsome Greenspan in 1967 entitled Gold and Economic Freedom, in the days when the man had an ounce of sense and integrity about him, which meant that he knew perfectly well that the only protection that you would have in the future would be through gold and not a dollar, which is a faith-based currency based on nothing but the faith in the American economic system, which is probably misplaced as we speak, although I think the dollar will rally at some point in the near future. But it's rather ironic that they have placed that article below the huge book which comes in just before it. So anyway, there you are. Heads up to all of you who wish to have some insight into the thinkings of this very twisted man. Okay, let's get to the mail because we're running out of time here. And I don't think I would like to miss the mail because that's the listeners calling in with their concerns. Okay, let's start with Farouk, who says, "Hello, Richard. I read an article in New Jersey Star Ledger yesterday on retirement planning. The financial planner recommended reducing taxes by using New Jersey tax-free municipal bonds instead of certificates of deposit. Municipal bonds are very attractive right now," he said. "Financial advisors have always had a fondness for municipal bonds, but from what you have shown us in the last 12 months, I thought munis are in trouble. There are reports that states are defaulting at faster and faster rates. Could you please comment? Thank you for your service, Farouk." Farouk, you completely understood correctly. Municipal bonds are at fault. What you also need to understand is that financial advisors get paid to sell you municipal bonds. They do not get paid to sell you treasuries and certificates of deposit get a very small payout to the average advisor. So that's why they are interested in having you buy these municipal bonds. They are not, of course, covered by federal government protection, as are CDs, certificates of deposit, up to $100,000. In addition, you have correctly understood states are having serious financial problems and difficulties, and this will, of course, impact the municipal bonds, which have already been impacted by having their AAA-rated status downgraded by virtue of the downgrades of the equivalent insurance protection behind them. This is a bad choice. Stay away from municipal bonds and stick to treasuries and CDs. Okay. Right. The next thing we need to deal with is Ralph's email. Ralph says, Richard, what do you think about Wells Fargo? I did a search on the net, and it seems that they are the second largest mortgage originator. The stock went up in recent 5 days. At the beginning of the jump, they announced that they have increased the dividend, which should signal no big troubles. But what do you think? Well, I think that Wells Fargo is in just as much trouble as almost all of the rest. And I would put them in the second-line category of banks which might go under. Be very, very careful of Wells Fargo. I don't think the fact that they're the second largest mortgage originator is of any great credit to them. All the stocks of most financial companies seems to have gone up rather dramatically in the last few days. It's what we call, you know, a dead cat bounce in a bear market, and of course they will all come back down again, rather naturally making them good short sale opportunities, albeit with a certain amount of risk because they have gone down so far that they could very well move up a little bit more. But stay away from Wells Fargo, and thank you for the call. Then we get Sheila, who comes in and says, that is still in their home, would like to stay put, however, are now upside down by a large amount. Please address the new housing rescue bill from the perspective of the homeowner that is still in their home, would like to stay put, however, now are upside down by a large amount, i.e. $150,000 to $200,000. Would this now be a wiser option for the homeowner to take advantage of in lieu of just walking away and facing the devastating effects of foreclosure? I look forward to your comments and show each week. Sincerely, Sheila. Well, Sheila, I now have to come and say the non-PC thing, which is no, they are tricking you into trying to make payments which you cannot afford, and you need to stay away, and you need, if possible, to walk away from this situation as fast as you can, and indeed you will have to face the devastating effects of foreclosure, but that is infinitely preferable to facing the debts that you will incur in all portions of your financial budget if you insist on making payments that you simply cannot afford. So that remains my advice to people, despite whatever else may have happened. So good luck. Now we have a call, George from Long Island. George, please go ahead and ask your question.
Richard, good afternoon. A fast question. Would it be fair to say that the rules or lack of rules for the banking debacle had to go through Chris Todd's banking committee in Congress? They had to okay it before it could be done?
Yes, it did. They did. The rules had to be okayed, of course. I mean, you couldn't... I guess you're talking about are you talking about the new legislation?
No, I'm talking about the original subprime mortgages. Did they have to get permission to change the regulations?
The original subprime mortgages, absolutely not. They were mortgages which were spun out of thin air by creative bankers and basically designed to create fees and commissions for the individual banks concerned, because what they would do is simply offer mortgages. I mean, you know, this used to be a free country. I'm not quite sure whether it still is, but you can offer whatever kind of mortgage you like. Nobody stops you offering a mortgage at 2% and then bumping it up to 6 or 7% if you feel like it. What should stop you is the financial prudence of doing so. But the banks basically got out of that one by selling off the mortgages that they had created to the big consolidators in faraway places like Washington, D.C., receiving money in return from those consolidation from those consolidators, with which they then turned around and made more loans. So no, there was no impediment, legal or otherwise, for them so doing. Although, as I have always said, the impediment was there theoretically, right in the hands of Alan Greenspan, who had the authority to stop that at any time. He could have stopped all those subprime loans at a stroke. He was given the legislative authority to do so in 1994 by Congress, and he did not avail himself of it because he wanted to be a hero, and he wanted to be loved, and he wanted to be the great maestro. And so everybody has now got to suffer in consequence. But there was no legislative impediment to doing that. Absolutely not, George. No, thanks for the question.
Thank you.
Okay. There's another email that came in from Paul in Deer Park, who says, I read a lot of computer magazines. I thought your listeners might be interested in a few excerpts from an article entitled I See It, Babes in Broadband. And I did actually send this out. I liked it so much that I did send it to my email list today. And I quote, some 65% of U.S. households with annual incomes under $50,000 who do not have a high-speed Internet connection. The U.S. now ranks a whopping 22nd in the world when it comes to providing its citizens with affordable, uber-fast Internet access. And in the last 7 years, we've dropped from 4th to 15th in broadband penetration. So far, the response from government has been, let them eat kilobits and leave it to the free market to sort out. Except, there's no longer any such thing as a free market, especially where telecommunications is concerned. With the passage of the Clinton-era Telecommunications Act of 1996, big telecom companies became huge telecom companies, and years of consolidations have created what economists call monopoly markets. As the Brattleboro Reformer editorialized on July the 11th, quote, broadband access in the U.S. is in the hands of the cable and phone company duopoly, which controls access to 98% of the U.S. online market. It is why Americans pay more and get less than what is available in the rest of the developed world. But the impact goes far beyond daily annoyance. It strikes at the heart of 21st century economic prosperity. According to the Reformer report, a Brookings Institution study found that nearly 300,000 new American jobs are created for every 1% increase in national broadband penetration. At a time when the economy is hemorrhaging roughly 60,000 jobs per month, you'd think that statistic would get somebody's attention. Well, thank you, Paul. Very interesting and very useful. Another email from D.R. Rich, who says, will the FICA still kick in for under 100,000? I think you mean the FDIC. FICA is the Social Security or Medicare tax facility. FDIC, yes, no problem. Even with the current defaults, you will get your 100,000 from the FDIC. No problem. All right, then I get Ralph, who writes in saying, hello, Richard, quick question. My girlfriend's brother lives in France, and he's invested in some copper company. He was also thinking about investing in some U.S. markets and some commodities like coal stocks. Do you think I should tell him to sell it? Also, he was wondering if there's anything he could invest or short in France. The answer to France is very difficult to short. They have a different compensation system. Shorting is really very perilous. It can be done, but it's very hard. Okay, continue. I'm asking you for this advice only because he lives in France. My assumption is to sell it and hold off with any investments, which I've already told him, until we hear reassuring info from you later in time. Please let me know what you think. Thanks again, Ralph. Yes, please invite your girlfriend's brother to sell the copper company. I see no value in holding on to commodity-related stocks or even commodities in general. I am more and more of the opinion that the commodities market has topped and that we are now headed back down in commodities along with the general deflationary environment in which we find ourselves. So I don't think that commodities should be in the portfolio of your girlfriend's brother, and coal stocks in particular have taken a big decline in the last few days and weeks, and I think that that is a process which will continue. Okay. Then I had an answer finally actually a week ago from Rene Martin, who I had asked to try to explain about Al Martin's comments and how she felt that he and I were at variance with each other. As a matter of fact, I must say that I have listened courtesy of two CDs sent to me from Margot and Hans Froelich. They were kind enough to send me some information about Al Martin. I did listen to some. I think the greatest difference between him and me is that he is very political. In fact, I believe that he has sort of coined a word, Bushonian. And Bushonomics, I guess that existed, but Bushonian is a new one on me. He talks a lot about politics. I really don't. I find that politics is going to happen whatever you do, like everything else, by the way, but the difference is that you can protect yourself against certain things. Against politics, there's not much you can do, as people found to their horror when they discovered that the government confiscated all their gold in 1933, just after Roosevelt had been elected. Governments will always do unexpected things. There isn't anything you can basically do to predict it. They don't. The government itself doesn't know from one day to the next what it's going to do, in my opinion. So it's a pointless exercise and very frustrating to try to deal with it. So I stay away. Not interested. From time to time, I will mention certain economic factors of the government's activities, which I feel to be relevant. But in general, whether I think McCain should be president or Obama should be president or this or that, all that can do is to irritate my listeners. So I'm not going to go there, and frankly, it doesn't interest me in the slightest to discuss these things. So I don't think there's anything. Renee sent me, you know, an enormous email, the longest email I've ever received from anybody, by the way. It was some 20 pages long. And I don't think that and I appreciate it very much, Renee, and I, you know, read bits of it, but I don't think that I want to pursue the political side of the equation. So thank you very much. Then we come to the daily rant from Steve Kruger, and I will stand back and read it and let the listeners go with it whichever way they will. So here it comes. The rant from Steve Kruger. Richard, in the year 1930, the United States had a population of 123 million. Today, we are at 300 million that we admit to. You can add another 35 million in what are called illegal aliens, but these, by all rights, are our slave population. In our advanced society, we have managed to have all the benefits of slaves without the need for chains. We are truly a creative nation. We simply deny them a social security card, give their kids a third world education in our public schools, a bit of emergency room treatment, and they are ours. When we enter depression with over twice the population of 1930, you can expect total madness. We will have no tax dollars to pay the police. They will not work for free, so they will take their guns home to protect their families. Our factories have been empty since the 1980s. We will not have any manufacturing to return to. There really is no way out of this. I would think this will start when the holders of our treasury paper decide they want out, then it hits the fan. Well, at least I'll have something to talk about when standing on the riverbank waiting for my turn to beat my clothes on the big rock. Thanks for wake-up call. Steve Kruger. Well, I think you have a point, Steve. I absolutely believe that you are hitting on a very important problem here, namely the size of the population. And frankly, the understanding that government simply cannot control in the same way as they did in times past the kind of social phenomena that are about to hit the system. And that's why there will be general chaos. And I absolutely believe it. I think you've got the right idea here. And until such time as people really get it, that we cannot live according to the norms of the past, and that the machinations of the people in power have overstepped their boundaries and created social chaos. Until we understand that, we're never going to climb out of this mess. And that, as always, has been the fear that I have, which is that there is no solution, and that basically this thing will have to play out. And that the kind of ideas that you have there will actually, you know, come to play. And by the way, you sent what you call a quickie, Steve, which is as follows. Richard, as the flock Americans on the world's financial mess, do you think that the European signatory nations will get out of the euro and revert to their own national monetary units, which you write as Monterey units? I think that's quite cute, actually, Steve. I like that. They're national Monterey units. They're national monetary units. I think many of them will. This is a danger that the euro must endure, and is one of the reasons why I do think that the dollar may appreciate against the dollar will appreciate against the major currencies, not because, as I always say, not because the American economy is in fact very, let's say, strong or healthy or superior to others, far from it, but simply because of the other currencies having tremendous problems of their own, as they're beginning to have. If we look at some of the exotic foreign currencies, they're beginning to weaken against the dollar. And also, as I've explained, the lack of dollars in the system through defaults and bankruptcies of one sort or another will create a hole, a kind of vacuum in the dollar, which will have to be filled by selling assets and selling foreign currencies in favor of the purchase of dollars. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it looks like we've come to the end of another edition of our Richard Martin's Wake Up Call, and I will be back with you on Thursday at 2 p.m. This is Richard Martin saying bye-bye until then.